Fascinating story of what happens. Jesus has returned back to Galilee, and he goes to speak at the synagogue in his hometown of Nazareth, where he has grown up. Here's the hometown boy coming back to his own hometown, where everybody knows him, everybody has seen him grow up. So we'll pick up the story here, Luke 4, verse 16. So he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. So first notice here that it is Jesus' custom, regular custom, to go to the synagogue on the Sabbath. He's just like any other Jewish male. He does that. That is his routine. That is his custom. He is not somebody who is doing away with the Sabbath. He is going to the Sabbath as his custom is. He keeps it religiously. And of course, as we covered in the first class, who was Jesus? What was his identity? We talked about in the first class that he was the God who interacted with people in Old Testament times. So he is actually the one who revealed, who gave the Ten Commandments to Israel, including the command to keep the Sabbath. So that just makes it all the more absurd to think that he came and is doing away with God's law, because he was the God who gave that law. So obviously that is just a nonsensical argument. So he does keep the Sabbath, not because he is Jewish. Some people make that argument. Jesus keeps the Sabbath because he's Jewish. No, he keeps the Sabbath because he is God. He is the God who gave the Sabbath day to mankind as a blessing and a benefit for us. So let's set the stage now for what is going to take place here. The people living in Nazareth, what is their background? They are religious Jews. Most of the people Jesus will encounter in Galilee are religious Jews. We'll talk about this considerably more probably tomorrow. So what has happened in Galilee? Did I cover earlier about the people settling, coming out of Babylon and settling in Galilee because they expected the Messiah there? They knew that the Messiah would appear in the land of Zebulun and Naphtali. Did I cover that previously? Okay, good. All right. Yeah, so this is most of what the people are in Galilee. They're very religious Jews. They've come from Babylon and moved there. They've come up from Judea and moved there. And we know this archaeologically, too, because a lot of these towns, like Capernaum, like Chorazin, the others that Jesus is traveling to, those towns didn't exist before the first century BC. They were founded as new towns by these Jews migrating into this area because they expect the Messiah to appear there. So these are very, very devoutly religious people. They want to be there when the Messiah shows up on the scene. So verse 17, let's continue with the story here. And he, Jesus, was handed the book. Just mention this in passing. It's not a book. It's referring to a scroll. You've seen the scrolls there, actually. Let's look back, yeah, like in the photo here. Those were the books. The books of the Old Testament were written on scrolls like this. So this is what he is handed. Books would not be invented for several more decades after this. A book, as we know it, something with pages that are bound together. So this is a scroll. He's handed the scroll of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the scroll, he found the place where it was written. And so again, the scrolls aren't divided into chapters and verses. So that would not come along until much, much later, 1600s, if I remember correctly. So he comes to a place in Isaiah where it says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." So he's quoting here from Isaiah 61. Let's take a look at that. Isaiah 61 and verse 1, which says, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me." So this is a messianic prophecy, and everybody there knows it's a prophecy of the Messiah. "Because the Lord has anointed me to preach good tidings to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. And Jesus stops at this point in reading from the scroll. But notice what the rest of this says and why this is very important to the Jews of that region in particular. To proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord, Jesus stops there. But Isaiah goes on to say, and the day of vengeance of our God to comfort all who mourn, to console those who mourn in Zion, to give them beauty for ashes, the oil of joy for mourning, the garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness, that they may be called trees of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that he may be glorified. And here's the part that really struck a chord with these very religious Jews in Galilee. And that is the next verse, verse 4. And they shall rebuild the old ruins, because Galilee had been invaded by the Assyrians back in the 700s BC. That's Tiglath-Pileser came in, exiled the people out of there. So they destroyed Israelite cities in that area, and most of them had never been rebuilt there. So the Jews of Jesus' day understand this prophecy, and they see themselves as the one to fulfill it. They shall rebuild the old ruins, they shall raise up the former desolations, the desolate abandoned cities, and they shall repair the ruined cities, the desolations of many generations. So the Jews of Galilee read this prophecy of Isaiah. They love this part because that's what they see themselves doing. They have returned out of Babylon. They've come up from Judea, and they're rebuilding the cities there that have been vacant since the Assyrians destroyed them centuries earlier. And they see themselves coming out on top now, where they ought to be. And they really love the next part of this prophecy too, verse 5, because notice what it says. Strangers, and this word strangers means nations, it's often translated Gentiles. So Gentiles shall stand and feed your flocks. And the sons of the foreigners, also a term for Gentiles, shall be your plowmen and your vine dressers. So the way the Jews of Galilee read this prophecy of Isaiah is that this is applying to them. It's referring to them. They're the ones rebuilding the cities. And the Gentiles are going to come and feed their flocks and herds. And they will be their plowmen. They'll be the ones out plowing the field. They'll be the one taking care of the vineyards, the gardeners, and so on. And they are going to be the ones on top. And instead of them serving those nasty, dirty, rotten Romans who are their overlords and masters there, now they're going to be the ones on top, and they're going to be the ones lording it over the Gentiles at last, which is the way it ought to be, as God's chosen people are finally elevated above everybody else. So they love this prophecy because they're in it. They're the ones who are now going to be on top. And then they can oppress the Gentiles, the Romans and all of these others, just as they have been oppressed for all these many years. So this is what the people there in the synagogue, when Jesus starts reading this passage, they know it again. As I talked about earlier, they have memorized large portions of Scripture. So this is one of their very favorites, because it's talking about them and how great things are going to be when they are in charge. So they knew the Messiah is going to come and establish a Jewish kingdom, and then they are going to be the ones in charge. They're going to be the ones on top, not the Romans. But rather than reading their favorite part that they love, Jesus stops halfway through that second verse. He stops at to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. And he stops there, and he doesn't read their favorite part, the good part, the good stuff. So looking at it from our perspective today, we know why he stopped. He stopped there because he does the first part in his first coming. He's going to do the second part in his second coming. So yes, he doesn't apply that to himself because that's going to happen far off in the future. when he returns in glory at his second coming. But the Jews of his day didn't know that. They think there's one Messiah who's going to come and do everything at once. So they see Jesus clearly claiming to fulfill when he says, this day is fulfilled before your eyes. They see Jesus clearly claiming to fulfill several well-known messianic prophecies, meaning that he is claiming to be the Messiah right then and there. But then he stops before he gets to the really good part. Consider the atmosphere that's going on in the synagogue at this point. They want to know, why does he stop? He's claiming to be the Messiah, but why isn't the Messiah going to fulfill the rest of this part? And we're going to be on top, and we're going to lord it over the Gentiles and the Romans and so on. So they're wondering, what's he going to say next? Where is he going with this? Why did he stop? What's going on here? So continuing with the story, verse 20, then Jesus closed the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. And the eyes of all who were in the synagogue were fixed on him. Now, that means they're watching intently. Okay, what's he going to do? What's he going to say now? What does this mean? And then verse 21, and he began to say to them, today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. So he has just said in no uncertain terms that, yes, he is the Messiah that this is talking about. He just quoted a well-known messianic prophecy and then said, this prophecy is being fulfilled right before your eyes in me. Verse 22, so all bore witness to him and marveled at the gracious words which proceeded out of his mouth. And they said, is this not Joseph's son? Now, this tells us that they marveled or wondered, as it could be translated in English. Marveled isn't a word we use very often in English today. It means they're wondering, what does he mean by this? Or they're puzzled by what he said. So his words are gracious, but that doesn't necessarily mean the audience thinks they are gracious. He says, they say, is this not Joseph's son? They're wondering, who is this guy? We know him. He was Joseph the carpenter's little boy who we saw growing up and running around the streets and so on. Who does he really think he is? Does he really think he's the Messiah? And as we'll see, they get very angry very quickly at what he says. Verse 23, he said to them, you will surely say this proverb to me, physician, heal yourself. Whatever we have heard done in Capernaum, do also here in your country. So by now they have heard of the miracles that he performed, of the turning the water into wine, of healing the nobleman's son, which we just talked about there at Capernaum. But he also knows how they feel about him in their hearts. And then he spells out how they feel about him in verse 24. Then he said, assuredly, I say to you, no prophet is accepted in his own country. What does he mean by that? Well, who are the people he's talking to in the synagogue? Well, again, it's the people who've seen him grow up. They knew he was a little boy of Joseph and Mary, you know, the illegitimate one, the one who was conceived when they weren't married. Yeah, that Joseph and that Mary and that Jesus. So there's no way they're thinking this kid could be the Messiah. There's the old saying we've all heard that familiarity breeds contempt. And that's what's going on here. They're familiar with him, and they wouldn't accept who he is and who he claims to be. That's what is going on. And then he says something that incenses this group of very religious Jews who are convinced that they are the chosen people of God. Verse 25. He says, but I tell you truly, many widows were in Israel in the days of Elijah when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months when it didn't rain and there was severe drought there. And there was a great famine throughout all the land, but to none of them was Elijah sent except to Zarephath in the region of Sidon to a woman who was a widow. So you can read about that in 1 Kings 17. We won't turn there. But this is where the story where Elijah stays with this widow and her son during this very severe drought and famine, and God sustains the three of them off this little bit of oil and flour that the woman has. But the key to this and what incenses the people, this is also why you need an atlas and you need to look these places up on a map. Where is the region of Sidon when Elijah lives with this woman? Where Elijah lives with this woman? It's not in Israel. It's along the coast of Lebanon. It's Gentile country. Gentile country, not Israelite or Jewish. So this woman wasn't an Israelite, she's a Gentile. And there's a severe famine going on in Israel, but where does Elijah go? He goes and stays during that famine with a Gentile woman and her son. So here's an example of God's mercy toward Gentiles. But again, the people hearing Jesus in the synagogue, they're looking forward to the day when they can be up over the Gentiles and oppressing the Gentiles. So Jesus gives this example of God's mercy toward this Gentile woman and her son. Not Israelites. Elijah didn't go to an Israelite during this period. So then Jesus gives another example, a second witness, you might say. Here again, principle of two witnesses. So second witness of God showing mercy to Gentiles and accepting them as well. Verse 27, and many lepers were in Israel in the time of Elisha the prophet, and none of them was cleansed except Naaman the Syrian. You can read about this in 2 Kings chapter 5. Naaman was a Syrian commander, military commander, sworn enemy of the Israelites. But Naaman, if you remember the story, had leprosy. He was a leper, and Elisha went and told him to go wash in the Jordan River 7 times, and he was healed. So what is Jesus' point here? His point that is that even Elijah and Elisha, who were considered the great, great prophets of Israel and Judah, weren't accepted in their own country and went to Gentiles and extended God's mercy and grace and healing to them. To a Gentile widow and a Gentile military commander. So Jesus gives two witnesses, you might say, Elijah and Elisha, of God's mercy toward Gentiles, right out of their scriptures, right out of the Bible. So they can't argue with that. They can't deny it because it's right there in the scriptures that they're well familiar with. So what is the reaction of the people who hear this? Well, it infuriates them, frankly. Because they are the chosen ones, not these Gentiles. They can't refute what Jesus says, but they are angry at him for pointing this out. So Jesus has not only claimed to be fulfilling messianic prophecies and thus proclaiming that he is the Messiah, but he also emphasizes that God's mercy extends to these despised Gentiles as they view them. But his audience is the people who came into Galilee to push out those same despised Gentiles and take over. And their reaction is immediate. And what happens next when they hear those words? And you have to understand the background to understand the reaction and what happens next. Again, if you don't know the history, if you don't know the background, if you don't know the geography, you don't know what's going on. So, continuing here, verse 28, in reaction to what Jesus says, all those in the synagogue, when they heard these things, were filled with wrath. And they rose up and threw him out of the city, and they led him to the brow of the hill on which their city was built, that they might throw him down over the cliff. So here you might say is Jesus' real homecoming. This is the reaction he gets. Here's a photo. Nazareth, I think I mentioned this before, is kind of built in a bowl. It's a city in a bowl surrounded by ridges. And here's a photograph of the ridge. This is the highest ridge. This is assumed to be the point where they take Jesus and they're going to throw him off the cliff, as is described here. And I think this is probably a pretty good candidate for that as well. It's very, very high cliff. You can see the size from the tree up there on the top of it. Quite a sharp, precipitous drop there. But there's more to the story than them just wanting to throw him over the cliff. What they're doing is actually planning to stone him to death. And that required, the Jews had had laws for everything that they had made up in this period. And Jewish law spelled out how to stone somebody to death, believe it or not. Spelled out very specific laws, a specific process. It wasn't something that was done in just a haphazard manner, where if you're going to stone somebody to death, you take them out and throw rocks at him. No, they had rules for how you stone somebody to death. The first rule was that the person being stoned had to be brought to the edge of a cliff that is at least 12 cubits high, or about 18 feet. If you didn't have a cliff, a two-story house would do, or a city wall, or something like that. You had to throw the person off first, so they fall 18 feet. They're stunned when they hit the ground, knocks the breath out of them, maybe knocks them unconscious, that kind of thing. So then the two witnesses who are required, the two witnesses are the first ones to cast the stones, which actually wasn't so much throwing, because if they push him off a building or a city wall or a cliff, they actually would take the biggest rocks he could find and drop them on the person. So you get a rock drop from about 20 feet smashing into the person there. And then everybody who thought the person was guilty would also come up and drop or throw stones on him. And if the fall didn't kill him, the stoning would. There was the thinking of it. So what do we see here that they plan to do to Jesus? As is highlighted here, they led him to the brow of the hill on which their city was built, that they might throw him down over the cliff. So this was the first step for stoning a person to death. Every person after he's thrown off the cliff will drop or throw rocks on the person till he's dead. If a dozen people thought he was guilty, he'd be hit with a dozen rocks. If 100 people thought he was guilty, he'd be hit with 100 rocks, and so on. Of course, this is fatal, usually fatal, but because putting the person to death was the whole point, and that's what they intended to do to Jesus. But if we don't understand this aspect of Jewish law, we don't realize that's what is going on. They are going to stone him to death here this early in his ministry. Jesus claimed to be the Messiah, and he said a prophet is without honor in his own country and among his own people. And he told them that God is merciful to the Gentiles, and that God does and will work through Gentiles whom they despise, and for this they want to stone him to death, but they don't get that far. Verse 30, as it says here, then passing through the midst of them, he went his way. So what happened? There's no explanation given here. Presumably some sort of miracle takes place, perhaps something like happened with the angels at Sodom, where the crowd is temporarily blinded. Perhaps there's a sudden dust storm or windstorm or something that blows up, and in the confusion and the blowing dust and all of this, Jesus slips away and gets away. We're not told. I mean, Luke here doesn't tell us this, but we don't go from a crowd that is determined to throw Jesus off a cliff to them suddenly just backing off and passively letting him walk away. No, there had to be something else that happened here. It's not his time to die yet. So he isn't killed at this point. So wrapping up this section, then he went down to Capernaum, down again from Nazareth to Capernaum, city of Galilee, and was teaching them on the Sabbaths. So he leaves Nazareth. There's no record of him ever going back there again. And then Capernaum becomes becomes his base of operations. So any questions about that? Hopefully none of you, when you go back to your hometown, will be threatened with being stoned to death. But that's what happened with him. And it makes more sense when you understand the background. Again, you gotta put yourself in the thinking of the people of that day, what they are thinking, to understand why they try to stone him, and that's exactly what they intended to do. Okay, well, let's move on to our next section here. Jesus comes to live in Capernaum. So picking up the story here, and leaving Nazareth, he came and dwelt in Capernaum, which is by the sea in the regions of Zebulun and Naphtali, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. It's called Galilee of the Gentiles because, again, the Assyrians had deported the Israelites and brought pagan Gentiles into that area in their place. The people who sat in darkness have seen a great light, and upon those who sat in the region and shadow of death, light has dawned. As mentioned, as we've covered, Jesus leaves Judea after John is imprisoned, and he goes up to Nazareth, has a very bad reception there, so now he has to leave Nazareth to save his life and settles in Capernaum to make that the center of his ministry. But why Capernaum? Let's talk about Capernaum specifically for a while here. Capernaum is a town of about 1,500 people, based on the size of the town, maybe as low as about 1,000, maybe as high as about 2,000, but roughly 1,500 people. It's one of about a dozen small villages or ports located around the Sea of Galilee in that day. Here's an artist's conception of what the town would have looked like at that time, laid out on a grid. You can go there and visit. I've been there four times maybe over the years. It would have had docks there for the fishing boats, commerce boats, and so on. There on the Sea of Galilee. Sea of Galilee, again, is about 8 miles wide, about 10 to 12 miles north and south, kind of a roughly triangular shape. So here's what the town would have looked like. Mostly one-story buildings, some a bit bigger. And of course, Peter and Andrew are fishermen, so they live and work here in this town. So you'll notice the synagogue here about a block from the shore, the lake, that will figure prominently into the story in several places here. And then just various houses, businesses, and so on around here. Here's another artist's view looking out of the town to the Sea of Galilee. Out here, you see the boats out here. You see Tiberias is the biggest city in the area. It's about, as the crow flies, about 5 to 6 miles from here at Capernaum down here on the coast. There are other fishing villages scattered out around the coast of the Sea of Galilee. Again, about roughly 12 miles from here down at the very southern end of the Sea of Galilee. Source of water for the Sea of Galilee, by the way, is the Jordan River. It feeds in on the northern end of the Sea of Galilee and then drains out the southern end. And today, the Sea of Galilee is Israel's greatest source of fresh water for drinking, for agriculture, for things like that. So this is kind of what it would have looked like. The buildings there are made out of stone. We talked about that quite a bit with Jesus' occupation. This stone is basalt in that area because it's actually a volcanic region. There's a big volcano about 3 miles away from here. Interesting story there. I could tell you about that sometime, but don't have time. It's where one of the greatest battles between the Crusaders and the Muslim hordes took place, is just a few miles away from this spot that ended the Crusader rule there in the Holy Land. And that's the source of the basalt, which is volcanic lava. It's a very hard stone. And the houses would have been plastered, as I talked about earlier, with a thatch and wood roofs on them there. And people would have done things on their roofs. Here's some fish laying out here, drying on the roof, laying on a reed mat, and a cat watching over them. Here's a shaded area over there where people would have... it's cooler on the roof of the house because you get the little breezes going through. So it's fairly typical in those days for people to sleep on their roofs because you got a nice cool breeze there during the warmer weather. So this is really a very, very good artist depiction of what a town of that day would have looked like. And again, the jetties and docks for the boats just out of sight right over there. Here is a photograph of the ruins of Capernaum from the 1800s. These white limestone blocks you see in the foreground are actually the ruins of the synagogue there. I'll show you a photo of that here shortly. And here's some Bedouin women in a Bedouin tent there. So these are the native Arabs who live in the area. Over here is modern-day Jordan across the Sea of Galilee in the Golan Heights. We're toward the left of the frame. So that shows what Capernaum looked like a little over a century ago. Ruins, again. This and most of the towns of Galilee were destroyed in the Jewish revolt that led to the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So that's why that and earthquakes. This is a fairly earthquake-prone region. So that's why the cities were destroyed in that area. Here is what it looks like today. Here's a tourist boat here just off the shore. This is a Greek Orthodox church there at Capernaum today. So that gives you an idea of what it looks like. Visibility isn't great there because it's several hundred feet below sea level, so there's typically a lot of haze and mist in that area. Here's another view of the synagogue, the white limestone synagogue structure there. You see the palm trees, date palm trees, and the dark basalt rocks that were used for buildings in that day. This limestone, incidentally, had to be imported in there, so this is a very wealthy synagogue. This synagogue dates to actually Byzantine period, somewhere 300, 400 AD. And so it's several centuries after Jesus. However, it was built on the foundation of an earlier synagogue that does date back to Jesus Christ's day. So you can't visit the actual synagogue Jesus was in, but you can visit the building that was built on top of the synagogue where Jesus would have been. And a very, very beautiful structure, partially rebuilt, partially restored. A lot of the stones aren't there because they were carted away and used in other buildings and other structures over the last 2,000 years. Here's what it looks like from an aerial view. Here's that same synagogue. And I've mentioned earlier the school next to it. That's what this structure is. Again, the synagogue would have been kind of a local community center. It's not a church as they would have Sabbath services there, but its building is not primarily as a church. It's a meeting hall. It's a community center. They would have had weddings and potlucks and meetings of the community, school. It's a dual use type building. And then you see the houses around it, scattered around. This just happens to be they've only excavated a fairly small part of the city of Capernaum. Here's some more of the white limestone blocks that from the synagogue that have not been restored yet. So rest of this outside those walls is unexcavated. So don't know exactly what is going on there. So here is a larger aerial view showing the shore of the lake. Here again is the synagogue. It's the most notable structure there that you can see. So you'd see this excavated area and more ruins out here. Here's the Greek Orthodox church that showed you earlier. More ruins outside here, parking lots and so on. So the tourist buses come up here and you can walk around and explore that area. Not much to see over in this other area here. It's been unexplored and undeveloped, but that gives you an idea of what it looked like. It's interesting that the site of Capernaum is owned roughly half by the Catholic Church, which is the developed part where the synagogue is. So they've turned it into a major tourist attraction. The Greek Orthodox Church owns the other half. And for whatever reason, they've never developed it, never excavated it, opened it up for tourists and so on. I don't know why, because the Catholics got the good part of the synagogue, so they get all the tourist dollars and so on. And the Greek Orthodox section gets hardly any visitors over there. However, having said that, there is something really interesting that they have discovered in the Greek section. And again, it's never been developed, but years ago when they were exploring that area, they did find the remains of a Roman military outpost there. And they know that because of the distinctive architectural style of that. Now, that might sound surprising, but actually it shouldn't surprise us, because what is Jesus record, the Gospels record healings of three people that took place in Capernaum, three very specific ones. One is the nobleman's son, we just talked about. One is the daughter of the ruler of the synagogue, Jairus' daughter. And the third is the healing of a servant of whom? A Roman centurion. He's probably the commander of the military base. They're in Capernaum, on the outskirts of Capernaum. So we shouldn't be surprised that there's a Roman military presence right there in Capernaum, because Jesus heals his officer's servant there. So this is one of those interesting intersections, again, between the biblical record and archaeology, that Jesus heals the servant of a military officer, and 2,000 years later, we find evidence of a Roman military outpost there in the very same city. So again, it's just one more verification of the accuracy of the gospel accounts. But why did Jesus choose this particular town out of the dozen or so ports around the Sea of Galilee, or out of all the other little towns and villages scattered around Galilee? Well, to answer that question, let me ask you another question. Why did God place the Israelites in the Promised Land where he did after he brought them out of Egypt? Why did he put them in that particular place? Why there? What did he want them to do there? What did he want them to be there? Why that particular location out of all the earth? Well, there is a scriptural passage that tells us why God put the Israelites where he did, in the land of Israel, and what he wanted them to do there. Deuteronomy 4, verses 5 and 6. Here Moses is recapping what has happened to the Israelites during their Exodus wanderings for 40 years in the wilderness, and he gives them their final instructions before they cross the Jordan River and go in to inherit the land. And the older, unbelieving generation has died off, and now the second generation, their children, have grown up to adulthood, and they're going to inherit the land. So now Moses encourages them, but also tells them what God expects them to do and to be in the Promised Land that he's giving them. So he says, Moses says, "Surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Therefore, be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who will hear all these statutes and say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people.'" So what is Moses telling them? Well, he's telling them, to simplify it, he's telling them that God has placed them at the crossroads of the world to be an example to all the other nations around them. And he tells them that if they obey God's commandments and laws, that other nations around them will say, "Well, what a great nation of wise and understanding people these Israelites are." And then they will be an example to show that God's way works. And if you follow God and obey his laws, you'll be blessed. So that was what Israel was to do in that land. Now, what was critical about that particular strip of land where God placed them? Israel today, look at it on a map, it's right here. It's roughly 150 miles long, north to south, and about 30 to 50 miles wide, depending on where you measure. Not big. It's about the size of New Jersey. Quite a small nation. And look at, and I'm sure you hear a satellite map to show the colors of it. You see all this yellowish white color. That's sand. That's sand. The green is vegetation. This little strip along the coast is green for the most part, at least in this satellite photo. What does that mean if in the ancient world you are traveling from, say, Africa or Egypt to Babylon over here, or the Assyrian Empire or the Hittite Empire, or vice versa? Where are you going to travel? You're going to travel where there's vegetation. You're going to travel along the coast. You're not going to travel through the desert because you're going to die. You're going to die out here. Unless you're a Bedouin and really knows the land and knows where the water holes are and things like that. But you're not going to take an army through that desert because there's not enough water. There's no food. You're going to die. So the travel is done right where? Right along the coast, right through this little strip, right where God places Israel. So that all of the nations to the north, over here, to the east, to the south, they're all going to interact with Israel. They have to, because it's right there at the crossroads of three continents, of Africa down here, of Asia over here, of Europe up here. It's right at the crossroads of the world. And that's why God places them there. And of course, most people travel by walking. And where are they going to walk? They're going to walk right through the Promised Land, right through Israel. Let's focus in a little bit closer here. It gives you a little more detail. Yeah, this is the land of Israel. This is the green part. You can see the Dead Sea right here. Jerusalem's right there. Here's Egypt down here, the Nile River and the Nile Delta, Sinai Desert. And over here is Jordan and Iraq and Saudi Arabia. And if you're traveling, you got to go through here. You got to go right through here. Where are the big empires of the ancient world? There's Egypt down here. There's a Hittite empire up here. There's the Assyrian empire over here, and later the Babylonian empire. Then there's the Persian empire over here in what is today Iran. So when these empires aren't fighting each other, what are they doing? They're trading with each other. So where do the trade routes go? Right along the coast, right through Israel. So God put them there at the crossroads of the world, the most valuable stretch of real estate in the ancient world. We're not just the smaller nations who are their immediate neighbors, like the Ammonites in what is today Jordan, the Syrians up in here, the Lebanese, the Phoenicians up along the coast here. Not just the smaller nations, but the bigger nations all around, the empires of that day, will interact with Israel. They will see a nation that lives by God's laws, as they were supposed to, as they should have. But of course, we know they didn't. And what happened? God let them be taken away into exile. But they were placed there to be an example of his way of life. And that's why God put them in the most important spot on the earth. Does it remind you of any scriptures? Any scripture come to mind, like Matthew 6, verses 14 and 15. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but they put it on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. So God has always used that principle, going back to the period of Israel. God wants his people to be lights, to be examples of his way of life so that others will be attracted to it and want to learn more about it. It was true of ancient Israel. It was true of, and it's true of God's spiritual Israel today. But what does this have to do, getting back to the question, why did Jesus choose Capernaum? Well, we just talked about how since ancient times, this was the main trade route. An invasion route. So that's why in the history of Israel and Judah, there are all the battles and the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Egyptians coming back and forth through the land because it was the major trade and invasion route. And there was a major highway, kind of the equivalent of one of our interstates, that ran from Babylon along the Euphrates River down through Syria, down along the coast of Israel, and down to the heart of Egypt. And this goes back to ancient times. It's well known by archaeologists. Again, you could not travel out here. This area is all sand or mountains and sand. You had to travel where there was water, the Euphrates River, along the coast where there was water, along the Jordan River where there was water, to the Nile where there was water. because if you didn't, you died, so you had to travel through there. So this was the ancient superhighway system. There were places where you could camp, campgrounds, you might say, to spend the night, to get food, to get water for your animals and feed for them. And this ancient road existed for thousands of years. It was called in Latin the Via Maris. Via Maris. In Latin, via means way or route or road. Maris means sea, as in maritime, mariner or so on. Maris, via Maris, the way of the sea. It's called the way of the sea because when it came down through Israel, it paralleled, and then towards southern Israel came right along the Mediterranean coast. We see these same city, these three famous cities on the map: Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. Solomon, it's described in his reign, one of the first things he did is he fortified these cities and made them military fortresses. Why? So he could control the trade and the traffic in this major highway that ran through the heart. That's one reason Solomon's kingdom was so wealthy, because he controlled all the trade that ran back and forth along this international highway system. Where is it in relation to Capernaum? It's right here. It comes from Megiddo, comes from down here along the coast, off the map, running right up along the coast and runs within a half a mile of the city of Capernaum, and then goes north on up to Syria and eventually Damascus and all the way out to ancient Babylon. But Jesus' ministry he's headquartered here in Capernaum, and most of his ministry takes place in this little triangle between Chorazin, Capernaum, and Bethsaida, an area roughly 3 by 5 miles. Is where most of his ministry, most of what we read about in the Gospels, takes place right there. So Jesus is right along. He chooses Capernaum because it's right on this major trade route of that day. What does that mean for his ministry? Well, it means that he doesn't have to travel everywhere to get his message out. Other people are traveling back and forth along this road all the time. So people are going to hear of his miracles. Travelers coming through on their way from Damascus to Egypt or Jerusalem are going to hear of his miracles. They're going to hear of his message. It's like putting up giant billboards and flashing lights. Miracle-working rabbi here. So people would know about that. And that's why we see phrases in the Gospels like his fame spread throughout all the region around Galilee. How does it spread? It spreads because he's on the ancient information Internet superhighway of the day. Word of mouth is going to spread of his miracles, of his teachings, and all of that. So he doesn't have to personally travel everywhere. He chooses a place right by the ancient superhighway where the word of mouth is going to spread. So Jesus chooses Capernaum here to be the center of his ministry for the same reason God placed Israel in that place, in that location. So word of mouth of his way of life and his teaching would spread to others. So others would hear about God's truth, and that very location would amplify that message. It would spread word to word, word of mouth. He didn't have to do it all himself. And so this would ensure that his word would spread not just through Galilee, but even far beyond that, to the north, to the south. That's why we see people coming from Lebanon, from Syria, to hear and learn about him. And the same thing is true when he goes to Jerusalem for the holy days too. He knows people are going to be there from all over the Roman Empire. So he goes and teaches in Jerusalem at the holy days. So they didn't have radio, they didn't have TV, they didn't have magazines, they didn't have internet then. So word of mouth was their internet. And Jesus uses this location to make sure that he is in a place where word of mouth will amplify and spread his message. So that, in a nutshell, is why he chose Capernaum. It wasn't random. It wasn't because he liked the climate or the view of the lake or something like that. No, he chose it for very strategic reasons to help amplify and get his word out. So that's it for today. We'll continue on with similar themes tomorrow and talk about more of what is going on in Galilee during Christ's ministry there.